Welcome to the Anderson Business Advisors Podcast, the nationally recognized preferred provider for asset protection and tax planning in the nation. This show is for investors and business owners looking to save on taxes and build long-term wealth with Toby Mathis, an attorney, author, business owner, and a featured instructor at Anderson's Tax and Asset Protection event held throughout the country. Enjoy the show.
All right, guys, let's see if everybody's out there. This is Toby Mathis, and you're listening to...
And Jeff Webb.
And we're listening to... You're listening to Tax Tuesday. I'm messing around with my computer, as I like to do. It's actually my pastime. Mess around with computers. How's Jeff doing?
Jeff's doing okay.
Let's make sure everybody can hear out there. If you can hear us, say, yay, I can hear you loud and clear. Somebody says, can you hear us? That's Patty. Let's see. Yes. So we have some people coming in. Yes, 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 yes. All right. Tell me where you're from and where you're sitting right now. So I'll rephrase that. Tell me where you're sitting right now. Are you in an ice storm in the middle of Dallas and Houston? Or somebody says ice cold Kansas City. Tell me where you're at. Let's just see. Irvine, Fort Worth, Palm Springs, 70, Cedar Rapids, Orange County, Atlanta, Big Island. Ooh, they're going fast now. Kapolei, Linwood, Washington. Oh my gosh. Tulare, New Mexico, Maryland. Sitting in my home office on Maui. Everybody hates you now. Everybody's like, eh. Durango, Colorado, Boston. No, nobody hates anybody for living on Hawaii.
But the people in Texas may be jobless right now.
They might be. Minneapolis, Minnesota with a negative wind chill, probably. Michigan, balmy Phoenix, City of Angels, Georgia. Chicago, Illinois. Fantastic.
Yeah, my son said the wind chill in San Antonio was 7 degrees this morning.
Seven. New Haven, Connecticut. That's like, I hope everybody's okay down there. Really worry about folks when they have their electricity go out, yeah. And that's no fun. Southeast Texas looking at the snow out the window. Yep. Hey, we had snow here in Vegas about 2 weeks ago.
Yes, we did.
So it's like Mother Nature's very fickle. New Jersey. Sorry, Edison. So we have people from all over the place. All right, so let's just dive right on in. Taxes, taxes, taxes. If you're in the United States, then this is relevant to you. If you have investments here in the United States, this is relevant to you. All right, so use the Q&A feature in Zoom. Don't use the chat to ask questions. Ask questions in the question and answer. Comments you can throw into chat, but just know we have hundreds of people on, and they'll oftentimes get just buried.
Yeah, they fly by pretty quick.
So we want to be able to see what's going on. So if you have a question, just pop it in there. And we have folks on to answer. Who do we have on today, by the way? Hey, Patty, unmute yourself and tell me who's on, because I can't see everybody.
We have Pio. We have Elliot. We have Susan.
We have
Tavia. We have Christos.
Wow. So we have you guys have a bunch of accountants on, bookkeepers. You got some power there. So make sure that you ask your question. And if you know, this is a good day to do it. It's one of the few times when I'm looking at the numbers where we're not just blowing it off the rails. So we're in the hundreds, but it's not the upper hundreds, if you know what I mean. So let's jump on in. If you do have questions that are longer questions, by all means, I'll go back, put it into the email to Tax Tuesday at Anderson Advisors. We get hundreds of those a week. We go through them. You should be getting answers. If you don't, just let me know. This is supposed to be fast, fun, and educational. We try to shoot for an hour. And if Jeff would just stop talking, we'd actually get done in an hour. But it's like a chatty Cathy. Try to make him stop. I'm just kidding. We've never finished at an hour. Or did we?
Yeah, but you weren't here that day.
Yeah, it's probably somebody else. Somebody says, I had a terrible time getting a link for the call. Yeah, I think Zoom's doing evil things today. So it's been a little wonky. Everybody is online, apparently. Somebody says, good one. They're rooting for you, man. All right. So let's go over the opening questions. How do you gift your son a fully depreciated rental property without causing a tax consequence? I want to be like that. All right. Why did I do that? I have a home and a second home in different states. Neither are rentals. And one of the largest unrealized gain is in a high tax state, but isn't my primary residence. How might I exchange that for a new home in another state without having it as my primary residence for two of the last 5 years and avoid a big hit when selling it. So again, I take these almost verbatim right out. Every now and again, I'll do an edit. When I read it, I'm like, oh, that's an interesting question. I just grab it. All right. I have an LLC created in New York State in 2013 that I use to run my books business. A bookie?
That's one of the things I thought about. But
however, I'm now pivoting to a web design business. In order to keep my business straight, should I create a DBA specifically for the web design business, or should I just open a new LLC? We're going to answer that too. We are considering purchasing a vehicle, which will be used probably 75% of the time for our real estate business. Is it advisable to purchase in the LLC, that's taxed as an S corp, or personally? Advantages or disadvantages of both? It sounds like a Jeff special. We'll go through that. Jeff just gives me the look. Excluding the 1031 exchange, is there any way to legally avoid paying depreciation recapture tax when you sell a property? I love the fact that you said legally avoid it. Let's see. My question is, when to collect and when not to collect W-9? In particular, I have several vendors refusing to give me their W-9, and I have to threaten to withhold payments. There was a follow-up on this one. They said they were corporations, so I didn't put that in just because it was getting long. Right. Can we sell our home on an installment sale to an IDGT, an IDGT, and then lease it back? That stands for Intentionally Defective Grantor Trust. At the same time, have the depreciation and other costs flow to our return because of IDGT taxation rules. That's an interesting one. We're going to play with that. All right. If I purchase a fourplex using an FHA loan and live in one of the units 2 of the 5 years, how are the capital gains taxes calculated when I sell the property? Is Section 121 exclusion valid for the entire $250,000? So we'll get into that. If I invest my self-directed IRA funds, so SIDRA funds is self-directed IRA, in a private company that is structured as a C corp, and they provide a form 1099 miscellaneous, not a 1099 INT or 1099 DIV for my earnings, will my SIDRA be subject to UBIT, which is unrelated business income tax? Can you explain? We'll answer that. I love all the little SIDRA, UBIT, IDGTs, CRATs, and GRATs. Can you explain the conservation easement and its benefits? Absolutely. We'll get to that. I have two entities created with assets and each one on them. Each one. I just love it. I grab these and I don't look at them again. So do I need to file two separate taxes, probably two tax returns, or combine them to one filing? And can we depreciate the solar system plus take the 26% tax credit? We have some good questions today. So you ready?
Yeah, I am ready.
So Jeff is going to answer every question today. And I'm going to sit duly by and just go like this a lot. Yes, Jeff. All right. How do you gift your son a fully depreciated rental property without causing a tax consequence?
Gifts in themselves normally do not cause gift or tax consequences. If I gift a fully depreciated building to you, Toby, it's going to be at fair market value. That will go against my credit, my lifetime estate credit, but it's typically not going to cause any kind of tax.
Yeah.
Now, on your son's side, he's going to take it in at your basis, which is sounds like it's going to be zero.
Mm-hmm.
So he won't be able to take any depreciation on the property. It's already been fully depreciated. Pretty simple.
Well, let's think about this. I like to make things complicated.
I know you do.
All right. So first off, Jeff's absolutely 100% correct. The estate tax exclusion is sitting this year at 11.7, and that's the same for the gift tax exclusion. So a lot of people think, oh, I can give, what is it, $15,000 a year? And you can give more than that, but then you have to file a gift tax return. What's that return?
The gift tax return is 709.
All right. So you have to let the IRS know, I'm using up some of my exclusion during my lifetime. So I could give an $11.7 million property. If I'm married, I could give a $23.4 million property with no tax consequences to my kid. For federal tax purposes, we still have to worry about the state. I don't think there's ever going to be a situation where there's a state tax, although you may cause a reassessment, especially now, as of today, in California, you'd cause a reassessment. And there's other places where it might.
What about transfer tax in some of these states? Is that going to be triggered?
Yeah, we're going to have to look at it. Like Washington State might be $2 million, some of these others, right? So you have to be aware of it. I don't think you're going to get into it too much when you're doing a gift. But again, every state's a little different. So check with your local, right? We have to say that. Check with your, or just have us look at it. All right. So you can definitely give it to your son, but the question is, should you? Number one, if you have to use it, you're going to have a little problem because your son could toss you, right? So you got to make sure that it's not a house that you need to stay in. I see that with parents. They'll give it to kids and they won't realize that the kid's about to go through a nasty divorce or they're being sued or there's something else that's coming up.
What I've seen done sometimes with this, with a rental property, is we put it in an LLC and then gift them maybe over 5 years, a portion of that LLC until he eventually completely owns that LLC.
You could do it. The only reason, so I'll give you guys a real life example. So I had some clients in Ohio and their father had gifted interests of a building. I won't get into all the specifics, but it was essentially the same situation. It was a commercial building, fully depreciated, very little basis. And they were concerned that the estate tax exclusion was going to be reduced. So the accountant said, let's give it to the kids. It was like four or five, and they spread it out. But the estate tax exclusion didn't come back in force. It was still a very large number. And all they did is manage to give an asset to the kids at their basis. And there was no step up in basis when dad passed away. So after dad passes away, the kids go to sell it. And now they have a tax liability. If dad had done nothing, there wouldn't have been an estate tax. There wouldn't have been any sort of tax to the kids. And they could have sold it and its basis would have adjusted. It's called a step up in basis. And it is on the chopping block for the Biden administration. They are talking about getting rid of it, but we never do anything until they actually do. And this is the great example why, is the accountant was in fear, caused the client to spend some money to do a series of gifts that then cost these kids a better part of about 25% on all that gain from this property that had been held for so long. And it was a pretty nasty scenario. It's like, ouch. Oops. So it's not, can you without triggering a gift tax? To me, it's, is it wise to do? Because what are you giving up when you do it? Well, you're giving up control. You're giving up the step up. What else are you giving up? You know, and I've seen it enough where, you know, it's usually mom and they're giving it to their kids thinking that they want to transfer it before something happens. Mom ends up needing assistance. Kids don't necessarily want to help. Now, all of a sudden, you have a house with somebody else on it. How do you, yeah, so it's something. Somebody says, oh, gosh, I'm not going to repeat that. David, you're being bad. All right. I have basically two homes. Let's just call it that. And one sounds like a vacation rental and one's a primary residence. So, we have a follow-up. What is their option? Sandra, what I would do is I wouldn't give it away. I would just hold on to it if I'm going to get a step up in basis. The question is, why were they giving the property away in the first place? And it's never really a good idea to gift things to somebody. Anytime I want to, like if I wanted to give Jeff $15,000, I could do that. But it's much better to have Jeff work for an organization and earn the $15,000 because at least I get a deduction for it. How do you give it to your son so they get the step up? You give it to them in a trust. You give it to them in a living trust so that the trust owns it when the original grantor passes. The successor beneficiary might be the child, or it could be descendants. It could be any number, whoever you're leaving, you'd get an automatic step up on that time. And then you'd avoid probate as well. It's like a twofer. All right. Speaking of twofers, I have a home and a second home. So I have two homes, and there's one with the biggest unrealized gain is in a high tax state, but it isn't my primary residence. So they're starting to sweat it. How might I exchange that for a new home in another state without having it as my primary residence for two of the last 5 years to avoid the big tax hit when selling it?
Well, there's several tests that IRS looks at, and the biggie is, where did you live the most? And they're going to count how many nights you spent in each home. There are secondary tests where they look at where your driver's license is registered, where you're registered to vote, and those kind of things, even what address you have on your tax returns. So it makes it very hard to just indiscriminately pick which house you want to be your primary residence. So the best you could do is, I would say, live in it for another 2 years and live mostly at the more expensive house.
You could do that. And you can have more than one primary residence. It's just on any particular year, you have to have the one primary. And yeah, they're looking at the factors, right?
Right.
So what Jeff is saying is basically make sure that you meet that test, and then you would qualify under Section 121. To have the capital gains excluded up to $500,000 for a married couple, $250,000 for an individual. However, if that is not something that is possible for you, then what I would do is I would make it into a rental property. I would rent it for at least 6 months, and then I would exchange it. I'd do a 1031 exchange into a new property that I would also rent for 6 months to a year to make sure that it qualifies as an investment property. And then I would take it out of service after that period of time, and I would make, you know, and I would use it however I feel like. So I'm going to have to give up about a year's worth of use to save the taxes. Or as Jeff says, you're going to have to make it your primary residence and make sure that, you know, something to think about is you can do this once every 2 years. So what you may want to be doing is selling the first one and moving into the larger one, waiting 2 years after you move into the larger one, buying another replacement from the first one, then 2 years later, do the same thing again. That would keep you from getting hit. If you're going to keep the first property that has the lowest amount of unrealized gain, and then you would just want to make sure that you're moving into it, like Jeff said, and spending the majority of the time in that state, making sure that it qualifies as your primary residence. So listen to Jeff. Question and answer. We don't really like these guys are knocking out all the questions. So you guys can absolutely ask a bunch. Here's one. If I transfer my rental property into a land trust, which will be owned by a single member LLC, also this single member LLC is under another holding company. Are we going to be able to continue to depreciate the rental property as we did previously? The answer is yes. It's not going to matter. The LLC, it depends on how it's taxed. So if it's a single member and then it's going into another holding, then it matters is how that holding company is taxed. If it's partnership or it's disregarded also, then it's not going to make any difference. If it's taxed as an S corp, it's going to make a little difference. If it's taxed as a C corp, it's going to make a difference. So for this individual, so for land, it's not going to make a difference to you. I can almost guarantee you. It sounds like you have a holding LLC that's there to hold your real estate LLCs. 99.9% of the time, those are partnerships or disregarded. You'd never have one. I shouldn't say never. I have seen one where the holding was owned by a corp because the person did not want any assets in their name. And it was weird. And that was even a C corp, which just kind of tripped me out. But they were accumulating, never selling. So let's see. There's some more questions, but can you rent out your second home and collect rent as well as have the deductions and depreciation? Yeah, that's the point. There's some benefits to it. All right. Somebody says, Jeff is looking good with that beard. Yes, he is. So I'm keeping my distance from him. He's a handsome man. All right, let's get into this. All right. I have an LLC created in New York State in 2013 that I use to run my books business. However, I am now pivoting to web design. In order to keep my business straight, should I create a DBA specifically for the web design business, or should I just open a new LLC? What do you think, Jeff?
This has nothing to do with tax, but for liability reasons only, I'd open up a new LLC. I'd keep those businesses separated. You don't want the first business affecting your second business.
That is a good point. How about from a tax standpoint? What do you think?
From a tax standpoint, they could actually be inside the same entity. So you'd have this LLC and this LLC, which are owned by another entity.
So, you know, first thing is anybody that's been on this for a while know that we like to say LLCs are not a tax treatment. So it's an LLC. We don't know how it's taxed. So let's just, you know, you could be a C corp, S corp, partnership. It could be a sole proprietorship. And so that's number one is how is the LLC treated from a tax standpoint? From a legal standpoint, it's different than you. So the liability of the books business is separate from that individual. So then if we bring somebody into that business and what they're saying is a DBA, which is a fancy way of saying doing business as is just me saying, hey, I'm operating under a different name. So I could have ABC LLC doing business as Jeff's Beard Products, right? And then Jeff could say, hey, you know what? I'm going to do Jeff's books underneath that same exact entity. They're all treated as one from a legal standpoint. So they're, you know, so if somebody, Jeff sells some bad beard product and their beard falls out and they sue him, they could go after his books business. So Jeff's right. We want to keep those isolated. If it's treated as a C corp maybe, and the books business didn't really do much, somebody said, Jeff's Beard Products LLC. See, I'm going to start it. But let's say that was a corporation, a C corp, I might be tempted to operate them in the same entity if and only if I have losses sitting in that same business, right?
Oh, that's a good point.
So I might be looking at it going, shall we bring in some additional revenue? Because I might lose those losses unless you made a 1244 election. If it's an S corp, if I have basis, then I could probably take it. But anyway, so I might look at that. I'm also going to look at where your business is located. So if it's all in New York, somebody says, yeah, Zoom is being bad today. I can tell that. We're just, our numbers are getting jacked around. So if you are trying to think of anything else, it's the state, there's that. I'm trying to think if there's anything else I could think of.
No, and a word on the DBA, its primary purpose is to let you advertise as something other than your legal name. Mm-hmm. In some places, it does give you a little bit of anonymity. If you're in California, it gives you zero anonymity because you can look up the DBAs and see who owns them. Mm-hmm. So please don't use the DBA for that type of legal protection.
No, it doesn't give you any. It's just telling somebody you can do a different name. Now, this is the one thing is that if you ever, like if you are really paranoid or if you have multiple businesses and you have different brands, I'm going to tell you probably to break the brands off into their own LLCs or if it's an S corporation, something called a Q sub. But if it's just something where you're a startup and you don't want to go through the expense, then you do DBAs and then you spin it. But DBAs generally are not, they don't have a designator on them. So it doesn't say LLC or Inc. Most time it's just going to be the name. So it might be ABC Inc. doing business as Jeff's Beard Products, doing business as Jeff's Books. And it's all one organization, one set of books, one tax return, all that good stuff. So it just depends on what you're doing. All right. We are considering purchasing a vehicle, which we use 75% of the time for our real estate business. Is it advisable to purchase it in an LLC, which is taxed as an S corp? Yes. Or personally, advantages or disadvantages of both?
This is somebody who's listened to Tax Tuesday before.
Mm-hmm. Yes, we do make fun of anybody who says, hey, how are you taxed? I'm an LLC. And we just deep down inside, we're laughing.
My opinion is if you're purchasing a vehicle for your real estate business, unless it's something like a maintenance vehicle or you're some type of utility vehicle, I would leave it on my personal name and then just get reimbursed for the mileage that you put on the vehicle. You're going to have to keep a log regardless how you're doing it. But as you've pointed out, the commercial insurance for having it inside the LLC is much higher.
Yeah, so there's several considerations. Liability, you're bringing that liability into into that business. If you're using it 75% of the time, maybe that's worth it. Number two, the tax consequences. There's no free lunch. So if a business owns an asset and provides it to an employee, there's a good chance that's going to be taxable to the employee. So in this particular case, it's not 100% of the usage is the business. There might be income inclusion for 25% of the lease value of that vehicle, which would be treated as W-2 wages to that individual. And then the cost factor, number three, which is the insurance is going to be arguably more expensive. Almost always, it's considerably more expensive when I do a commercial policy versus an individual. There's a fourth one, which is really depends on the value of the vehicle. If I'm buying a G-Wagon and I'm throwing it in and I'm taking accelerated depreciation or something, and it's a heavy, heavy vehicle and it qualifies over the 6,000-pound gross vehicle weight, I could write that thing off now. But I can only write it off once. That's the problem. If I write off a vehicle, I am done. I don't get to write it off over and over and over again. I am done with that vehicle. But if I'm reimbursing Jeff for his vehicle, it doesn't matter whether if he's driving a 1989 Chevy dually, that's what I had, it's still, 57 cents a mile. Whether the thing's worth $500 or $50,000, I can now reimburse and be pushing money into Jeff's realm tax-free and non-reported for the mileage. And so I generally look at these things a little differently. I see a lot of accountants pushing people to have their vehicles inside their entity. And I've had clients who were just, one was in a bank line at the getting an AT, going to the ATM, but they were in the drive through and they rolled forward and tapped somebody in front of them. It was a business van. The person said it was just a tap, you know, and they're like, oh, you know, no damage. Oh, don't worry about it. Until about 18 months later, they get served for the soft tissue injuries of the children in the back seat. And they went after the business. Because the business, their perception is that they have more insurance.
Right.
If that vehicle had not been a business vehicle, you would have had probably not much of anything, and you just walk away from it. But in this particular case, there was no way to disguise it. They had it on the side. But still, when somebody discovers that it's a business vehicle, all of a sudden, it's a very different animal than an individual. Yep. And you bring that liability squarely into the business as opposed to keeping it personal. Would never want you guys to do that. Plus, if somebody's driving my vehicle, the business vehicle, and they cause a major accident or cause a death, it's the business is defending that. Yep. So it's going to presume, the presumption is going to be the liabilities there. You're going to have to show that they weren't authorized or weren't doing business or whatnot. It gets sticky. So I prefer, me myself, I think it's so much cleaner just to do reimbursements at the mileage rate. Just think about it. If I'm doing 10,000 miles a year, that's $5,700 that I can give to myself that I don't have to report as taxable income, that I get to write off. And I get to do that every year, regardless of what that vehicle is worth. Asset Protection Workshop coming up. It's coming up February 27th. If you like this type of information, you want to learn about LLCs, corporations, pension plans, solo 401ks, UBIT, qualified or unrelated debt financed income. You want to learn about land trusts. You want to learn about living trusts. You want to learn how all these things work together to minimize exposure from a liability standpoint, to minimize your tax and to create legacies. Come to the Tax and Asset Protection Workshop. It's absolutely free. Clint and I are teaching this one. And if you've never seen Clint, like, Jeff is a handsome man and Clint is right there with him, except he looks like a Ken doll. Is that fair?
That's fair.
All right. So we're having fun today. It's because Zoom is wonky. It's making me wonky. All right. So by all means, come out in there and register. It's free and we'll send you out the recording too. And it's fun.
Did you give them the link?
Yeah, it's right there. And then somebody sent it out too.
Okay.
You guys can see I'm looking around there. Let's see. Question and answer. My guys are all over this. Elliot, or I should say your guys, because they're more your guys. Elliot's rocking it and Pio's rocking it. Tavia's rocking it. Patty's even there. She's rocking it. Susan's rocking it. Matt's rocking it. You guys are just rocking. So there's nothing really for me to answer. Excluding the 1031 exchange, is there any way to legally avoid paying depreciation recapture tax when you sell a rental property?
I have one way. And going back to the 1031 exchange, you do not get out of the depreciation recapture because you're 1031 exchange. You still have to recapture. There's only one way I know of to avoid depreciation recapture, and that's don't have any gain on your sale. Your recapture is going to be limited to whatever your gain is. It will never be higher than your gain. So It's a little hard to get out of.
Yeah, so there's that. There's not getting out of it, but if you want to defer it, you could always do an installment sale or do a qualified opportunity zone. If you want to avoid it entirely, transfer it to a charity and then sell it.
Now, with a qualified opportunity zone, because it's still taxable in that initial year, I don't think does it get included in under qualified opportunity
zone? My understanding is that okay. It does, I believe. I remember Clint was, we were having that same conversation about the capital gain and the depreciation recapture and how they treat it. And they treat it all as one, is my understanding. We could always look into it though. But that's still only going to defer it for what, 5-6 years now?
Yeah.
5 years? Yeah, 6 years. Because you'd have to pay it. It's treated as though it's sold on December 31st of 2026.
Okay.
Yeah. So you still have to pay it. So if you want to avoid it entirely, put it into an exempt organization. You say when you sell the property, what if you never do and you just die with it? Then you don't have to worry about the depreciation recapture. So the step up takes care of that. So just die. Somebody says never sell, wait for step up. See, it wasn't that far. So if you have a relative that's talking about selling their rental and you're the beneficiary, just take care of them. But I want the step up. Your Honor, I did it for the step up.
I've been telling my mother that and she's not being a team player.
Look at this pillow. You're getting very, that's horrible. Do not joke about things like that. That's horrible, Jeff. Anyway, so other than the 1031 exchange, you have very few options. Again, spread it out over time by doing an installment sale. Maybe defer it on the qualified opportunity zone, subject to a second opinion. We have to take a look at that. Don't sell it, just die and step up. When I inherited at fair market value, is the depreciation recapture gone? Yeah, it's gone. When you inherited at fair market value, the whole thing stepped up. You re-depreciate that, right? Mm-hmm. You get to write it off even though nobody paid any taxes on it. The best thing in this world is to inherit something from somebody who passed away.
And that goes back to the question about gifting the house to the son.
You lose that.
Yeah. If the son inherits it instead, he gets to start depreciating it all over again.
And you get, yep. It's like, that was the that was that group. It was four or five kids. And I remember just going, the accountant was still their accountant. And I'm trying to be nice. And I'm like, well, actually, there's no way to avoid it. Well, why'd they do it? Well, they're concerned for the estate tax. The estate tax is like $5 million. I know, but there was a worry that it was going to go down. What? And I'm sitting there like, oh, God, they're going to figure out that the accountant was the one who told them to do it. And it was not a small amount of money. Oops. All right. So here's a question. My question is when to collect and when not to collect W-9s. In particular, I have several vendors refusing to give me their W-9, and I have to threaten to withhold payments. And the part that I cut out was these vendors are all corporations saying that they don't have to.
And they're incorrect about that. They still have to complete the W-9, but you're not required to issue them 1099s.
But you better do it anyway. Here's the thing. I get, because we got dinged by this. We went through, we were one of the 50,000 companies that they did this massive 1099 W-2 audit. They picked randomly 50,000 companies, and they went through every single 1099 and W-2 that we had. We had binders of this for them. They came in and it was like, sit down and enjoy yourself. There was two vendors. One became number two on America's Got Talent, was a magician that we hired for a holiday party. And the other was a landscaping company that had gone out of business that was a corporation. And they said that unless we could prove that they were a corporation, we had to pay the tax on it. And we're like, how do I prove? Like, well, you have to get a statement from them. I'm like, you can look at the database. It's right here. Well, you have to get a signature from the owner. I'm like, well, it was 3 years ago and they're out of business. How am I going to get it? It ended up being like $500. So we said, hey, forget it. We'll just do it. But make sure that you get that W-9 because that would have solidified it for us. So even when they tell us that, you just say, well, give me proof that you're a corporation, please.
So best practice is before you even contract with them, get that W-9. Mm-hmm. So don't place an order and then ask for the W-9 because you're going to run into this exact issue. The second way around this is pay for everything with credit cards. You do not have to issue 1099s for anything you pay with credit cards.
I like that. Yes. Somebody says leverage. Lever them. Use a credit card. Get the points.
Yeah, it's a little stronger if you say, I'll buy something from you if you fill out this piece of paper.
Yeah. Just fill it out. Oh, let's see. If I had someone who passed away, I believe they have me as a beneficiary of a living trust with real estate. Will I be taxed for the properties if I have not acquired the business as of yet? So the property taxes go with the properties. It's not an individual thing. It's going with the properties. So they'll just lien the properties if you don't pay them. So you'll still be on the hook for it. If you sell it, you won't have any capital gains or depreciation recapture if it's the same value, if it's close to when they passed. So you're not going to have to worry about that, but you do have to worry about the real estate taxes. There's no way to avoid that, even if you inherited it. Somebody says, I have a rental property in Indianapolis through a self-directed IRA out of Chicago. My permanent residence is in Rhode Island. Am I protected? Well, depends on Rhode Island's treatment of IRAs. The general answer is the individual is responsible for the real property that's held in the IRA. So the individual in the IRA is personally liable for the activities of the real estate, and then can they take the IRA from the individual with liability? The answer is yes. In most situations, they're going to be able to take away an IRA, which is why a lot of times you're going to do an ERISA plan like a 401k, and you're going to shut that down. Or if you're going to own real estate inside of a plan, our recommendation is that you put it in an LLC that is owned by the plan. Don't just set up an LLC willy-nilly. It's got to have specific language in it to make sure it's not a prohibited transaction. So you can't be authorized to make money as its manager. You need to make sure you're specifically putting in language to disclaim that to make sure that you don't inadvertently step on a rule that blows up your strategy. But I don't know. I like owning real estate inside of retirement plans under certain circumstances. I was talking to some people today, really high income folks. And, you know, they're always looking at depreciation, all this stuff. And I said, well, I'd rather have the tax deduction this year. So if I have a choice, I'm going to, you know, if I put a dollar in a retirement plan, it saved me 37 cents. I'm way out ahead, mm-hmm. Right? I'm already 37% ahead. Now, if I buy real estate, I'm okay not getting that depreciation, right? I'm like, hey, you know what? It's okay. I'm not going to pay tax on it either. And if I never need it, that's even better. If I start taking the money back as an RMD, required minimum distribution, when I'm 72, that's going to be that on average, that's taxed at about 10%. It's actually a really low amount, even for high income people. By the time they retire, they're taking it. Somebody says, my mom passed away a couple of years ago and she had two properties in her trust. I am trustee and beneficiary. Both properties are paid off. Can I take the depreciation again? The rental properties, yeah.
Yep.
All right. Hey, follow us on social media. If you're not, go to YouTube. That's a great one. Check us out on Facebook. I know we're pretty active out there. I don't even know how to use Instagram, I'll be honest. I've seen it. My wife's really good at it. My daughter's awesome at all these things. And I suck at them. But Anderson's good at them. So you could go. I'm sure it's fantastic. All right. This is where we get to talk about IDGETs. I've been waiting to talk about IDGETs for years. Can we sell our home on an installment sale to an IDGET and then lease it back? At the same time, have the depreciation and other costs flow to our return because of the IDGET taxation rules?
So like you said, the IDGET stands for Intentionally Defective Grantor Trust. It's an irrevocable trust that ain't really an irrevocable trust because you put wording into it to make it a grantor trust.
For tax purposes.
For tax purposes. For legal purposes, it is that.
The question is, it's intentionally defective for what?
For tax purposes.
Yeah, so it's a grantor trust, intentionally defective.
So here's the problem with that. You can't sell your home to yourself, which is basically what would happen here.
It's the old, can I have my cake and eat it too?
Yeah.
No, you're not allowed to. If you wanted to have the depreciation cost, then you have to also recognize fair market rents, which is going to offset the depreciation and cost. So if I rented my house to Jeff and I said, oh, I want the depreciation. Well, it's just a deduction based on the usable life of the property and the assets therein. If I break it down. So what's my benefit? Nothing. Going to offset each other.
And he mentions the IDGET tax rules. Well, the problem with the IDGET is it's the tax rules for whatever the individual is.
So I gave away, so I put something into an irrevocable trust and I have two choices. Is the trust going to pay tax on it or am I going to pay tax as the grantor? If it's an incomplete gift, if it's an incomplete bequeathment or transfer, then it's defective. Or if I put in language that it's incomplete and I continue to act as its trustee and things like that, then it's just going to be taxed as though it's ignored. So an IDGET is a fancy way of saying, ignore it for tax purposes. It's there for asset protection. So you use an IDGET when you are like for an asset protection trust is a good example. So if you set up a Nevada asset protection trust, a NAPT, which is also a DAPT, which is also a hybrid trust, all those really neat words, it's a fancy way of saying, hey, it's in a safe. And I control the safe. So if I open up the safe, the IRS says it's yours. Whether I put money in my safe or take it out and put it in my pocket, it's still my money for IRS purposes. So an IDGET is just that. It's just a safe.
So what about instead of doing it through an IDGET, I sell my primary residence to, well, no, that's not going to work either. I can't sell my primary residence to my S corporation and then rent it back to myself.
You wouldn't rent it back to yourself.
I'd have to rent it out to another party.
So, you know when you might do that? So Jeff's talking about selling your primary residence to an S corp. And when would you ever do that? Like, why would you ever do that? Well, if I want to increase its basis and I want to take advantage of my 121 exclusion. Mm-hmm. So let's say I have a house that I paid $250,000 for. It's worth $600,000. So I could sell it to my S corporation. And I would do it on an installment sale. So the S corporation doesn't have to come up with all the cash. I'm married, so I would exclude up to $500,000 of capital gains since it was my primary residence. I don't have recapture. And so let's say 250 to six, what is that? 450,000 or 350,000. I would exclude from my capital gains. I wouldn't have any capital gains. I would then have the S corp opt out of the installment tax or sale rule and treat it all as taxable in year one. And since there's no tax, who cares? It would continue to pay me over time. But now that S corp could depreciate it at $600,000. So I just gave it an additional $350,000 of depreciation, which is not a small amount. So yeah, so you could do that. If you followed that, you get a star, but, or you're an accountant.
Have you shown them your coffee cup?
That's a good coffee. You guys probably can't see it, but with my bowl. Mm-hmm. Patty made me this, guys. And it's one of my art drawings from one of our deals, one of our...
One of your seminars?
One of our live streams. And I drew a cow, well, bull. It was either a cow or a bull. It's either horns or ears, but whatever the case. And she's so impressed with my drawing that she made it into a coffee cup. It's a bull. All right. Yes, I have my bowl.
I like this next question because it confuses a lot of people.
Okay. I'm confused at it. If I purchase a fourplex using an FHA loan and live in one of the two, one of the units, so they have four units and I'm living in one of them, 2 or 5 years, how are the capital gains calculated when I sell the property? Is the 121 exclusion, yeah, 1031, is the 121 exclusion valid for the entire $250,000?
So when you do this, you bought the fourplex, you're using 25% of it. You actually have two separate properties in one building. You have your rental properties, the other three apartments, and you have yours. So what it comes down to is when you turn around and sell the property, say you've made, I'm going to use $200,000 instead of a profit. You apply $50,000 of that profit to your personal residence, and the other $150,000 goes to the other three apartments.
Mm-hmm.
So unfortunately, that $250,000 Section 121 exclusion only applies to the portion of the sale that goes with your residence.
Must have been lived in 2 of the last 5 years as your personal residence. So if you want to knock out 2 of the units, live in one of the units for 2 years, move to the next one, live in it for 2 years, sell it, you'd get half. But isn't that neat?
Now, what we had, I've had.
I don't want to move anybody. I don't want to move.
I've had clients do in this case is they use the 121 exclusion against their gain on the personal property and 1031 the rest of it.
Yep. And you're allowed to do that. You could 1031 the whole property if you wanted to put it all into, you know, move out of the unit, make it into a rental, use up as much of the 121 exclusion as you can, 1031 exchange the rest. Where this really would come into play is if you were in a coastal city that had huge appreciation. So you bought a fourplex 20 years ago, you've been living in one of the units and and you've been renting out the others and it's gone up in value $1 million, and you know you're going to get crushed in taxes because you're going to recapture the depreciation plus you have all that gain. This is where you could use the 121 exclusion to wipe out a bunch of it. So let's say it was $1 million of appreciation. 1/4 of that would be $250,000. So if you're single, you don't pay any tax on your gain. And then you could 1031 exchange the other three units, like Jeff said. And yes, you can, and it works.
And what I like about when you have a really big gain on a property and you 1031 it, you can buy multiple less expensive properties to make it up and then turn around and sell those off one by one just to start picking up the gain and bringing in the proceeds.
So yeah, so what Jeff is saying is if I have one property that had $1 million and I rolled it into 10 properties, I can sell those onesie twosies and recognize
little gain here, little gain there.
And by the way, your capital gains are taxed as low as 0%. So people are always telling me, oh, my capital gains is always 20. No, it's not. It's 20% if you make a lot of money. If you're over $500,000 or so, if you're married filing jointly, you're at 20%. Otherwise, let's keep you below that and you're going to be taxed at 0, 15%. Which makes, again, a strategy like that where you buy multiple properties and you're going to take 1/10, I might not be paying much tax on that at all. I might be paying an effective tax rate of 7.5% or something, depending on what my taxes are, which is why you hire good accountants and you do the numbers before you sell it. After you sell it, it's too late. We like to say, oh, you could have done this. That's our favorite thing in the world to do.
It's a really bad time to be asking questions afterwards.
Mm-hmm. Could I have avoided the tax? Absolutely. But I didn't. So what do I do now? You pay it.
You pay the tax.
But if I had a time machine, we could go back in. Somebody says, which would be better to safeguard cash assets, an IGIT or a Wyoming LLC? They're both really effective. An IGIT is a bazooka that's never been fully tested because it's a bazooka. Nobody wants to get in the way of it. Now, there's very few cases on NAPS, which I would end up using Nevada, or I would do a Wyoming statutory trust if it was me. I'm partial to Nevada because you can't get through them. And they're immediate. If you don't have a creditor, it's immediate. People say there's a 2-year seasoning period. That's for known creditors or somebody that's already a creditor to make a claim. If you have something where you're worried about liability right away, you do the LLC, but you can use them in combination. So I can have an LLC and I could transfer it to an IGIT if I'm concerned. And then the other thing is Nevada, this is, I'm sorry to say this, but it's the only state where your NAPT or your IGIT, your Nevada Asset Protection Trust, we actually have a statute. So it's a credit shelter trust, is protected even in the case of alimony. So if you're married and you're worried, Nevada's your friend. So if you're if you're in one of those relationships where you're like, just know that you'd have to make sure that everybody's signing off on it. If it's your separate property, so like if you have an inheritance and you're concerned, then you could put it aside in an app to make sure that there's never a question that it's going to get drawn into a divorce, or if there's a big age difference between spouses, that might be appropriate. We have all those situations out here because we have all the casino execs doing knuckleheaded stuff. Hey, make sure that you subscribe to Anderson on YouTube because we're always putting out new information, and we have Coffee with Carl and Tony Talks.
I thought it should be Tea with Tony, but Tony Talks works too.
Tea with Tony. We're not in the UK. We are in America. Where we drink coffee.
She does talk American.
She does talk American. No, Tony's awesome. Yeah. She's a rock star.
Yeah, good information from both of them.
Yeah. Carl, I'm just kidding. Carl's awesome. Carl grew up at Georgetown, Texas. So it's probably families all huddled up together, breathing on each other to stay warm. Hearts goes out to those folks. That sucks.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, I grew up in Philadelphia, then moved out to an island in the middle of Puget Sound called Vashon. And if the wind blew like 10 knots, your electricity went out. So we had two fire stoves, like wood burning stoves. So whenever it would snow or it was really windy, you couldn't take the ferry to the mainland. Sounds weird. Actually had a Thanksgiving once where we cooked it on the turkey on the wood stove. You would just cut wood. And some of these people are not in that situation. I would bet you they're wishing that they had some wood pellets and something to, maybe they can cut up their furniture. That would suck. All right, let's stop talking about that. It's all me. If I invest my self-directed IRA funds in a private company, what is the, that is structured as a C-Corp. So they invested monies into a C-Corp, and the C-Corp provides a 1099 miscellaneous, which is weird. For my earnings, will my self-directed IRA be subject to UBIT?
I couldn't get past the 1099 miscellaneous
part. It's got to be a dividend.
Yeah.
Because what are you getting paid for?
There are times when you invest in certain, say, LPs or something like that, that you might get a 1099 misc income through your brokerage.
Mm-hmm.
But I've never seen it from a private company because your self-directed IRA cannot do work for the corporation. It's not possible.
That's what I'm wondering. Whether you invested funds and then you went to work with it, you better make sure that, like, you just disqualified your IRA. Like, I hate to say it, like, you probably want to talk to somebody quickly because you can't use your labor to benefit the self-directed IRA. Now, there is a ROBS transaction where you can do that as long as it's at the inception of the company, and you could possibly do it then, but this is weird to get a 1099 miscellaneous. What I would probably do is say that they misqualified it. It's probably a 1099 dividend, and they're trying to write it off because they don't know what they're doing.
And I actually saw this with my mother. I'll bring her up again, who received a 1099 for earnest money. And it was just because the way it was coded in the bookkeeping software. So it could be a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
I hate to diss somebody else's tax work, but could be maybe they're not sure of what they're doing, but
we should make fun of them. Yeah, no, it's weird. So C Corp, a 1099 miscellaneous is for work that you did, in which case, if for whatever reason, that's actually your problem isn't unrelated business income tax. It's, did you work for that company? And what situation can you not use your own labor? You cannot use your own labor when it's self-directed monies or when it's qualified monies like a 401k or an IRA exempt.
What's the term we use? You can't pick up a hammer.
You cannot pick up a hammer and do like, so like, yeah. So that's, Jeff's using a great example. Go over it.
So let's say you put a piece of property in your self-directed IRA. You can't do any work on that IRA primarily because that's benefiting you personally. Yeah, it's benefiting the IRA, but in turn, that's benefiting you. You're generating income by increasing the value of your property and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I can pay Toby to come in and work on my property.
You can oversee but you can't do the work. So I could hire Jeff to come in and clean my gutters, but I can't go out and clean my gutters if it's my IRA or 401k that owns the property. Here's a good question. Somebody, I'm going to go back to questions. Somebody says, I probably have 25 plus years of past tax returns and it's supporting documents, including info on past and present properties. Can I actually toss these or do I have to keep them selectively?
Here's what I would do. Technically, you don't need to keep anything older than, we'll say, 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
I would have them all scanned, and then you have them forever. They're not taking up room.
Put them on a cloud,
mm-hmm.
a fluffy cloud. No, put them in the cloud. Put them in a document box. Put them in Box or Dropbox or one of those things, just in case. Because someone's going to want it for your depreciation schedules if you've owned those properties for 25 years. Because I know that every time we have a client that's had properties over 25 years and you say, hey, do you have the depreciation schedule? And they're like, I wrote it all off. What's the basis? What's that? Didn't I depreciate it all? You don't depreciate land. You had other costs that were tied into the transaction. So let's make sure we know what our basis is. Oops, I just went past this question. Can you explain the conservation easement and its benefits?
Conservation easement in general is, it's a legal term where it is a promise not to change the nature of the property. It's basically a conservation movement thing. What? That sounded wrong. Anyway.
I put Jeff on the spot. He knows that I like conservation easement, so he's probably thinking, nobody likes to answer.
I've actually seen these for millions and millions of dollars. I've seen it in raw land in Montana. I've seen it in golf courses in Georgia.
Our past president was a big user of conservation easements on his golf courses, including Mar-a-Lago, where he now resides. So a conservation easement is kind of as its name says, it conserves the land. It's an easement that you give to a organization. Generally speaking, it's going to be like a Ducks Unlimited or some sort of land conservation 501c3 or an organization where you're giving it to them. And their mission is generally to keep properties in their natural state. So I might give them an easement to the mineral rights. I might give them an easement towards the development rights or the land usage or the air. And I might give them all these things so that nobody can develop my property in the future. Or if they do, there's severe restrictions. So it can only be used in particular ways. So for example, Mar-a-Lago, the past President Trump went out there and I think it was 6 lots and gave the development rights to, I want to say 2 or 3 of them, to a conservation company with the intent that they could never change the open air nature of that land. So if you're somebody who's on that property, maybe you have, I don't know if there was housing in Mar-a-Lago or not, but the property is always going to be open and there's a benefit to society by having open lands, right? Mm-hmm. And so you get a deduction for that as a charitable donation up to 50% of your adjusted gross income. And it's based on what it does to your fair market value of your property. So if those lots were worth $1 million and you give away the development rights and they become worth $500,000, you would get a charitable donation for the difference between those two figures. In Trump's situation, I believe it was a $5 million or $5.5 million deduction. And he's done it to multiple properties, including in New Jersey. I think he had over $90 million in charitable deductions because he was giving away the development rights of all of his golf courses so that they would remain golf courses.
And a little bit about that fair market value that you were talking about. That fair market value is based on best use is the term they use.
Best use, exactly.
Which means when is it worth the most?
Yeah.
For what kind of use?
You're restricting the use of anybody, whoever comes in and buys that property or inherits that property forever. That's one of the big ones, is making sure that it doesn't go back, that it's not something that reverts back because it would destroy the gift. But the best example is somebody who has lands that are for cattle or something where they're economically, they're struggling because they're raising cattle on land that's becoming more and more costly and the taxes are going up. And they're like, I'm going to have to sell this. But if somebody comes in and says, hey, I'm going to push in money into an organization, we're going to see what's the best use of this property. And our intent is to see what the value is, to see whether it's worth developing, if it's worth developing, what its maximum amount is. And maybe we give away the mineral rights and the development rights to a conservation company. That's worth money to somebody who's willing to go through the rigmarole to do that. So the cash may go to the rancher so that now they don't have to worry about covering expenses, bills. The organization takes over the taxes, and anybody who put in money might be able to receive a larger donation because they just basically gave up all that upside in their investment by giving it away to a conservation company. Somebody says, how is it no self-dealing if Trump uses Mar-a-Lago as home? He probably has to pay for it, right?
I don't think he uses Mar-a-Lago for home because I won't even go into that.
Where does he live?
I'm thinking it's not Mar-a-Lago. It's his country club, but it's not his residence.
So he may have a different residence. Yeah. Right. You're allowed to self-deal, by the way. I should say this, that Mar-a-Lago is a for-profit organization, my understanding, and they gave away development rights. You just have to pay fair market. Even if you have a charity, you could still self-deal with a non-foundation. So if it's not a private foundation, if it's a public charity, as long as it's arm's length, you get a second opinion as to the validity. It's like, you know, everybody has to deal with it. If you're paying somebody money, you should probably have somebody make sure it's a reasonable amount. Mm-hmm. And you're de facto, you're good if you have a third party looking at it saying it's reasonable.
And I think in his case, the conservation easements were not for the residential areas. It was for the undeveloped land or the golf courses.
Well, so he did two, again, I remember some of it. I have to go back and refresh it. It was the country club where they maintained a bunch of antiques. And then every year they have a gala and people could see them. And then they had a couple of lots that they gave the development rights, and that got him where he wanted to be. There's a lot of good conservation easements out there. One that we were looking at last year, we had some clients invest in, was in Vail. And it was a developer who had done all the developing in an area, mm-hmm. and said, hey, we'll take one of them and give it away if you guys want to put money into it. And they basically raised a set amount and said, hey, we already had the development done. We've already done. But if we want to leave this, it was where two rivers met. And they said, if we want to keep this, because it benefits everybody to keep this land the way it is and not develop it, but it was worth a heck of a lot under the development rights. And, and usually you're going to get about a 4-to-1 benefit. So if you donate $1, you might get a $4 deduction. If you're in the 20% tax bracket, you went backwards. If you're in the 37% tax bracket or higher, you did all right. You know, still, you're going to make a 20 cents on the dollar, but that's the incentive. They want you to do good things. Somebody says, if my income is $100,000 and 50 of it is long-term capital gains, is all of the capital gains taxed at 15% or would a portion be taxed at 0%?
I don't have the brackets in my head, but I'm going to say it's probably not going to be 15%.
So if you're at 100, depends on whether you took your standard deduction or not and whether you're married. So let's assume that you're married and you didn't take your standard deduction. You'd take your 24,800, whatever it is, deduction. It would get you down to like 70 some. And then you'd look and say, if you're married, you have up to $80,000 last year and you'd still be in the 0% tax bracket. So you wouldn't pay any tax on your long-term capital gains at all. If this is after the standard deduction, then you'd have a good chunk of it that's at zero and a portion of it that's at 15%. It's not retroactive, right? You go bits and pieces. All right. I have two entities created with assets in each one of them. Do I need to file two separate tax returns or combine them into one filing? What say you, Jeff?
That depends on a whole lot of missing information. We don't know what type of entities these are. I actually asked Toby about this question beforehand.
He said, did you pick this just so you could be annoying? And I was like, no, I said, this is something we don't get all the time.
We don't know what these entities are. Even if you told us they were LLCs, that still wouldn't be helpful.
If they're both disregarded LLCs, two entities, I set up two trusts. I set up two land trusts. I set up a land trust and an LLC. I set up, you know, a NAPT and a Wyoming statutory trust. I set up a land trust and a living mm-hmm. trust. Like, all of those are disregarded entities. And you would never have to file any tax returns. If two entities, one's an S-corp, one's a C-corp, you're going to have two tax returns. If I set up two entities and one's an S-corp and the other one's a Q-sub, you're going to have one tax return.
Right.
Like, the combinations are endless. And we're just talking federal. Because I could have 50 tax returns in one entity if I get technical, like baseball teams and stuff, right? Hockey teams.
Yeah. So you may only have your 1040 to file. You may have to file two business returns for these entities.
why does Jeff pick these questions? Anyway, that just gets to the point, is that you get to choose. It's check the box regs. You get to decide. And so if you have assets, I have two homes and I own them both as disregarded. You have no tax returns. You file it on your personal tax return. That's it. Can we depreciate the solar system? So it's a solar system plus take the 26% tax credit.
Well, we can't depreciate the solar system because that's the planets and the sun. And I know what you mean. So
assuming, you guys thought I was bad.
Assuming that this is a income producing property, a rental, you would take the 26% credit and then you would, how do I say this, depreciate the balance plus half of the credit you already took. So
I like watching Jeff think.
Watch me squirm.
So the tax credit, there's two types of property. So if it's you on your personal residence, there's a provision that lets you have the tax credit.
Correct.
And if it's Jeff as a landlord, there's a provision that gives you the tax credit. Plus, it's an asset, income producing asset, in which case you can depreciate it. But if you took a tax credit, they take half of that and subtract it off the basis. So, yeah. So I always think it's like, I was just say it's 87% this year. Yeah. I can depreciate 87% of it and I get a tax credit for 26% of it. So if it's a $10,000 solar system, I don't know if such a thing exists, but let's just use round numbers. Then I would get a $2,600 tax credit, which is dollar for dollar against my taxes. Mm-hmm. And I don't lose it. I just carry it forward. If I don't have taxes, I don't know if it's refundable or not anymore.
It's not refundable.
So I just carry it forward, right, into future years. Mm-hmm. So it's just like a credit. Hey, I got a credit for $2,600 that I'll use against taxes that I owe. Plus, I'm going to depreciate the installation in the solar unit, whatever I put up there. And so I would get an $8,700 tax deduction. And then the question is, what income is it producing? What income do I have to offset? So I think it would still be passive, right? So we'd still, if it's attached to a rental property, so you'd have your depreciation, it would still be subject to the passive activity loss rules. But what a tasty treat. Like if anybody's looking for where, me personally, what I'm looking at, I'm looking at solar systems on rental properties now. As soon as this pandemic eases up and materials are more readily available, which is going nuts right now because this real estate market's on fire. That's going to be something second half of the year, I think we're going to be looking. And you could do it right up till year end, as long as 10%, which could just be the plans are in place before the end of the year, you could take the credit. For the depreciation, I believe it would have to be put into service, right?
Now, is this credit still scheduled to go up in 2022? I know it's scheduled to go up in 2021, and it did not.
Scheduled to go away or to be reduced?
I thought it was to be reduced.
It was going to go to 22%, and then at the end of December, under the COVID relief bill, the very last one, I always forget what it's called, not CARES, but the most, the one
in December.
It was right at like December 22nd or something. They extended it. They extended a whole bunch of stuff. And the solar, what they did is they said, hey, go back to 2020 and we're going to do that for a couple more years. And then it starts to go down. So I believe 2021, 2022, it's at 26%, 2023, 22%. And then I think it's gone in 2025. So, okay. So something. But I hope that they jack it back up to 30%, frankly. You know, it's all the nasty stuff that's going on in Texas right now, in Houston specifically. And there was people taking snapshots of their Tesla solar walls, heating their houses and still operating. So I think that there was some cases where the wind turbines froze, but the solar is still operational. So it's one more thing to put in the back of your head. If you get a big tax credit for it, it's just like it's everything's on sale for 26%. All right. Go listen to our past Tax Tuesdays if you want. This is what's really bizarre. I'm so used to having so many questions and we're always stressed for time. But with Pio and Elliot just knocking it down, with Tavia doing such a great job, and Patty and Susan taking care of the clients, and Matthew making sure that things don't glitch, it runs so smooth that we're getting through all the questions. So yeah,
somebody said, Christos.
Look at that. Jill just helped me out. Taxpayer Certainty and Disaster Tax Relief Act. Who the hell came up with that? TCDTRA.
Speaking of taxpayer disasters, IRS.
Christos, too. Oh, Christos is on, too. But Christos, he's kind of slow. No, I'm sorry. Christos does a great job, too.
If you're having issues with IRS, welcome to the club. IRS is a train wreck right now. We have people getting notices for returns they filed months ago.
They're still processing the mail from July. They sent out a press release. You actually grabbed a couple of it, and I put a little video together. I'll tell you what, they put out a press release that they're still opening mail from July.
And it's in the millions of number of parcels that they have to open.
Yep. You remember we were talking about the truckloads that I was getting reports that there was truckloads unopened and locked at the Fresno facility. The accountants were talking about, which means these things have been sitting there for more than 6 months unopened, and they're just now opening them. They're processing stuff that's coming in, but they're going through the backlog. Somebody says Christos is awesome. Yes, Christos is awesome. He's right next to my office, and I never hear him. I'm convinced that he doesn't speak in there. I'm just like blah 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 blah. I never. Yes, he is awesome. Boy, people come to his defense. I forgot.
I mean, he's just like.
I know. I want to see Christos get mad someday. He's just like the nicest guy. All right. So podcast, go in and check him out. If you like tax stuff, somebody's coming to, and now they're saying Elliot's awesome. All right. No, Elliot is awesome. All of our guys, like we have a really good crew here. You guys don't realize that there's more than 300 of us and we're all a little nuts because we all live in Vegas. Well, not all. So there's some up in Tacoma, some in Wyoming, some in Salt Lake. Actually, we have people all over the place. It's always fun. Somebody says, will you host a special on solar tax credit episodes? Number in the show notes for this one or follow-up email. Manic, of course. That sounds like fun. We should do a solar tax and just dive into it. So for you, we will do that. I'll make sure that we get something. Feel strongly about these things because we've known that our grid, and shoot, if you live in Texas or California or New York, you've had the joy of having brownouts and rolling. Yes, all sorts of fun stuff.
When cold makes your power station shut down, you may need to update your infrastructure.
Somebody says, I sent in a question about R&D when I signed up today. Where'd you send it, Ronald? You should ask it. Just type it out, or unless it went to Tax Tuesday if it's long. Hey, somebody's Patty saying register at the Tax Tuesday. Most people know we're just about done. So you can send in your questions, Tax Tuesday at Anderson Advisors, or go online, just visit us. Register for the upcoming February 27th Tax and Asset Protection Workshop. If you like this stuff, if you want to gain a little bit of make your edge a little sharper, come on out. There's stuff that's always changing in the tax world, in asset protection world, in the business world. So we love to keep people up to date. We love to get your feedback too. We learn a lot of things from folks that are out there doing it. There's only one way to figure these things out, and that's by constantly interacting with people that are doing, because everything else is old information. So by all means, email us. And thank you to everybody who came on today. Yep. And we will see you in 2 weeks at another Tax Tuesday. Make sure you bring in all your questions and we'll get rocking.
Thank you for listening to today's podcast. Show notes for links to everything mentioned in this episode can be found on our website at andersonadvisors.com/podcast. Be sure you subscribe to our podcast. And if you are already a subscriber, please provide us a review of what you thought of this episode.